Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Rizzo. For the record, I'm Robert Gibbs. I'm with Wilson, Howbrook & Byard, and I'm representing the appellant, Janice Russell Conaway. I appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument today on behalf of my client. I believe this case can be decided so that the trustor's clearly expressed intent may be carried out in the spirit of a long line of Chancery Court cases confirming that important equitable principle. And I also believe this case can be decided without violating another line of decisions of the Court of Chancery, giving maximum effect to contract principles, freedom of contract, and the enforceability of contracts in accordance with the agreed upon terms of the parties. I think it's important to note at the outset that the issue in this case arose on May 11 of 2010. That was the date that Everett Conaway passed away. The issues did not arise in 2002 when Everett Conaway and Jesse Conaway entered into their limited partnership agreement that contained a consent provision, nor did it arise in 2007. In 2007 was the first time Everett Conaway amended his revocable trust agreement to leave Janice Conaway 10% of his partnership interest. And it didn't arise in 2009 when Everett Conaway secondly amended his revocable trust agreement to leave 100% of his partnership interest to Janice Conaway. But on May 11, 2010, when Everett Conaway passed away, by operation of law, his revocable trust became irrevocable. The direction to his trustees then became effective and triggered the trustees' obligation to seek consent from Jesse Conaway in his dual capacities as then 100% owner of ConFam, the general partner, and as trustee of his own revocable trust, the remaining limited partner. And that's pursuant to Section 11 of the partnership agreement. I believe the court below erred in basing its decision on a non-existent inter vivos obligation of Everett to seek consent to modify his own revocable trust agreement.
Gibbs, would you stop 1 second
and yes,
raise the podium a bit if you can so you can get closer to the microphone? That's good if that's not uncomfortable for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jesse can only withhold consent. Janice Conaway does not dispute Jesse's right to withhold consent to the direct transfer of Janice's of his partnership interest held in the trust to her. His right to do so is clearly provided in the partnership agreement. But while remaining successor co-trustee of the Everett Conaway Trust, he can do nothing else towards defeating the intent of the trustor. As argued on this appeal, I believe it's easier, I think it was somewhat confusing in the case below, to analyze the respective rights and obligations of the parties, assuming that there is an independent successor trustee trying to carry out the directives of the trustor, Everett Conaway, leaving Jesse to do what he can do as not a trustee. It just clears the record somewhat of the difficult analysis when Jesse stays in that dual capacity. After the independent successor trustee or co-trustees seek consent and Jesse refuses consent to the direct transfer of the interest to Janice, Jesse argues that since the direct transfer of the interest to Janice cannot take place without consent, that the direction amounts to a failed gift. The court agreed without directly holding. The court erred in this finding. Janice argues on this appeal that the interest cannot fall into the residuary state as a failed gift. It can only do so absent intent to the contrary. I cited cases in the opening brief, and I listed numerous evidences of contrary intent, the greatest one being the very amendment to the revocable trust agreement that stated very directly that Everett wanted his interest to go to Janice. The purpose of the partnership was uncontested throughout this proceeding. It was set up for voluntary gifting for tax avoidance, and there was a cessation of the gifting in 2005 after only three 10% interests were conveyed. There was an amendment to the trust in 2007, further evidence of Everett Conaway's intent to benefit Janice. There were significant statements made to Robert Halbrook in 2009 at the time Everett was considering whether he should try to terminate the trust agreement modify his trust documents further. There's other evidence of Everett's desire to terminate the partnership and leave the Fulton stock to Janice because he believed that Jesse would not consent. Everett's inquiry to Stephen Ellis just before he modified his trust documents and his estate documents regarding termination of the partnership, and Stephen Ellis's response, it did never said that he could not do what he requested to Mr. Ellis to do under his estate documents. His estate documents were modified, and I strongly feel that this is not a case of an inoperative or specific devise or legacy. It was not conveyed prior to Everett's death. It still is in the trust, nor is it a lapsed legacy. Janice is still with us.
Now, while you're there with the trust, and there was a subsequent email from Mr. Ellis to Jesse about what would happen if the state got involved, and I believe Mr. Ellis said that the partnership could continue for 25 years.
That is correct.
And my question is that still a possibility? Because when you read the briefs, it seems like as a result of the death, the trust has to be, you know, distributed. So can the partnership really continue for 25 years at this point in time?
I think theoretically it can continue for 25 years. I think that there is no need for that to happen, and I think that the successor trustee or an independent successor trustee would then have the ability, once it is found, that the direct interest to Janice cannot transfer because of the withholding of consent, and there is no finding that it falls into the residuary clause for all the reasons I've just stated, then it sits in trust. And then I believe that the successor trustee has the ability to go before this court or the Court of Chancery and say, there's no purpose to leave this partnership interest in the trust for 20 some years, whatever's left, because there's no purpose in this partnership any longer.
The Vice Chancellor said that the testator's intent controls construction of his will. It cannot change pre-existing contractual obligations. What's wrong with that analysis?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that as far as it goes. The only contractual obligation that there is in this case is for the trustee of Everett's trust to seek consent prior to the transfer. That's the only contract provision that's applicable in this case. And I think that the successor trustee, I don't think that arose until after Everett passed away. And at the time Everett passed away, the successor trustee should ask Jesse in his dual capacity as his general and limited partner, are you going to consent to the direct transfer of the interest to Janice? And if she does not, I think that he then, as I just explained to Justice Holland, I think he has the right to go forward so that it doesn't simply remain in trust for 20-some years to seek dissolution of the partnership, a statutory right.
So where are we with your argument? Let's assume we follow you so far. Nothing really happened until Everett died. And then at that time, you acknowledge Jesse could consent or withhold consent.
Correct.
And he's apparently withheld consent.
Correct.
Now, where do we go next? How does your client ultimately prevail?
My client then, I believe that she has the ability as successor trustee to request the very relief that I have sought and sought below in a more equitable fashion and on appeal through a dissolution of the trust, a termination of the partnership, excuse me.
Well, if the partnership is terminated, how is she going to obtain any money?
If the partnership is terminated, the Jesse Revocable Trust, the stock representing his interest would go to Jesse, and the stock representing Everett's interest, the 69%, would go into his. The stock itself, not the interest is already there, the stock itself would be distributed to the trustee, and the trustee would carry out the directive of the trust and distribute that to Janice.
And the problem with accomplishing that is there are co-trustees?
Right now, the successor co-trustees are Jesse and Janice.
So we have each of them voting opposite directions.
Well,
with regard to the dissolution of the partnership.
I think that would be for the court to decide if there is a legal basis upon which 17802 is met. And I don't think the court could not hear it because one of the successor co-trustees doesn't agree to place it in front of the court.
So
maybe they would both resign and put it.
What's Janice's standing again? To independent.
Janice is
the dissolution of the.
Well, Janice is a beneficiary under the revocable trust, which became irrevocable. She's also a co-trustee. Jesse is the other co-trustee.
Right. Well, that's the trust. What about the LLC?
The partnership. I'm not sure what the court's question is regarding the LLC or partnership.
Remind me again what it is you believe she has standing to seek dissolution. The basis for her standing to seek dissolution.
As successor co-trustee of Everett's trust.
But she could do that even if the other co-trustee objected.
I believe so, yes. I believe that the court would hear it, and if there's, I mean, I'm not a practicing trust expert. I don't know what happens if co-trustees don't agree on a course of action, whether they file something in the court to seek, an appointment of a successor trustee if they have something that they can't agree upon. But the directive is there. The directive
is. Let me make sure I understand one thing in the record. Everett gave Janice his interest in the limited partnership, not the value of the interest. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what the vice chancellor held is that he couldn't give her the interest without Jesse's consent.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
And to that extent, he concluded, as of this point in time, that was an ineffective effort to make a transfer that failed. And because it failed, it went into the residue. Is that right?
That is what the court held.
All right. So remind us your theory of where the court went wrong.
First of all, the court went wrong, in my view, stating that the gift was somehow void ab initio. Again, this is an area where I felt the court did not really articulate how the interest got into the residuary. The court just noted in the background section of its first decision on February the 15th that it stated the appellee's position and then never stated that by operation of law or by such case or anything else, how the interest got into the residuary. It didn't hold. Then on the re-argument decision, it confirmed that it went into the residuary and went to Jesse.
But if assuming that nuanced distinction is correct, you seem to acknowledge that it couldn't be transferred to Janice after Everett's death. So we move away from void ab initio to void upon death.
Okay.
And aren't we still in the same place?
It's not. I don't think it's void. It just simply is. It is an interest that is held by the trust. It is an interest subject to a condition upon transfer. If the condition is not met, it sits in trust. I argued vehemently it does not fall into the residuary. So it sits in trust, and it would stay there until there was an event of termination.
All right. So that's really your focus, is putting aside void to the extent it was ineffective without Jesse's consent. It simply meant that the partnership interest stayed in Everett's trust.
Right.
Now, is there any provision, remind me, that requires Everett's trust to be terminated at any point in time?
I think there are three conditions, agreement, the yearly 25 years from whenever the beginning date was, and a sale of all of the Fulton stock. Any one of those three events would trigger termination.
Of the trust.
And I believe that statutory termination is also an available remedy. How we get to that when you have dueling co-trustees, I can't answer the court procedurally, but I'm confident that there is a way to have that issue heard, raised by one or the other, or by the dismissal of both and putting in an independent trustee. I think that the court has to be able to hear whether that statutory remedy is available or not. And I don't think the opinion of one trustee or another is really binding on the court. I think the facts exist or they don't.
In your opening brief, you indicate that Janice admits that the Court of Chancery's decision allowing Jesse to, quote, withhold consent to the direct transfer of the interest to Janice is an appropriate application of Jesse's rights under the LPA, or the Limited Partnership Agreement. I think I misspoke earlier and referred to it as a LLC. I have LLCs on the brain for some reason. Is that an argument that was fairly presented to the Court of Chancery? Is that admission inconsistent with the position that you took before the Vice Chancellor?
I don't think it's inconsistent, Your Honor, but I will acknowledge candidly that it wasn't clearly presented, because the focal point in the briefing below was that there was this situation where Jesse obviously has fiduciary duties as the successor co-trustee of his father's trust, and the obligation to carry out the directive and intent of his father while at the same time working to stop that transfer from occurring and trying to redirect it into his own pocket. And I argued the intent of the testator to the contrary. I argued that a trustee should be able to seek termination of the trust in order to carry out the intent. I did not argue specifically the line of cases that I cite on this appeal as to the law that supports the contention that
you say it may not have been clearly presented. The standard we generally uses under Rule 8 is it was fairly presented to the trial judge.
I believe it was fairly presented, Your Honor, in the overall context of the arguments that were made.
Okay.
I don't think I ever disputed that the contract provision was there and that Jesse had a right to speak on that point, but while he was sitting on both sides of the fence, he couldn't do so.
Okay. Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, I'm David Rudd, appearing today on behalf of Jesse Frederick Conaway. My friend has asked this Court to ignore the mandate of the General Assembly in passing the Delaware Revised Uniform Limited Partnership Act, give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract by permitting Everett Conaway to breach his contractual duties to Jesse Conaway. And I'm going to refer to the parties by their first name just for ease of understanding. The appellant's argument really does not address the contractual obligations that Everett or his trust had to Jesse or his trust under the limited partnership agreement. The certificate of limited partnership, as well as the limited partnership agreement, clearly sets forth a bundle of restrictions on the assignability of any partnership interest.
Does it address what happens upon death?
No, it does not. It does not. The agreement is silent on that, Your Honor. But
why is there a restriction in that event?
I'm sorry?
Why is there a restriction in that event?
That goes to the whole concept of fair dealing and the obligations that arise under that theory. And when you have a good faith and fair dealing in any contract, and the Limited Partnership Act clearly retains that as an obligation in this situation, the courts have read that when you look at the entirety of the circumstances, you can make a quasi-reformation, so to speak, and imply that that is what the parties intended. And that's what the Court of Chancery did in this case. The court looked at the restrictions that were set forth in the limited partnership agreement in the certificate, the fact that it would require unanimous consent of all of the partners to effectuate any assignment to a third party, and also looked to the fact that if any party wished to withdraw from the limited partnership, that there was a severe penalty for that withdrawal, and that penalty being, again, they would require unanimous consent, and if the consent was given, there'd have to be a 50% reduction in any payment that went out. So the court below found that there was this bundle of rights. Didn't specifically state that this should be written in, but clearly implied that the intent of the parties, Everett and Jesse, to this limited partnership, when they set this partnership up or established this partnership with the agreed upon purpose that it was to transfer assets by way of gifting to minimize any estate tax from Everett to Jesse, that when you take that whole bundle of what concept with the purpose and how it was to be effectuated, that any attempt to transfer those rights or those partnership interests without first seeking the consent of the others rendered Everett's assignment to Janice void. So that is why, even though it's not stated specifically in the limited partnership agreement, it's our position that the court properly held that the interest could not be assigned from Everett to Janice without the prior consent of Jesse. Having breached that obligation, then it was a failed or ineffective attempt to transfer and then pass through the residual clause to Jesse.
So your position would be we don't breach the dual role that Jesse plays as a limited partner and as a co-trustee because there isn't any role for him as a co-trustee as it applies to the proceeds that were void on the initial attempt to transfer.
That would be correct because under the terms of the trust, and in response to a question Justice Holland raised, the trust language is very clear that at Everett's death, the obligation of the co-trustees is to distribute the assets. So once a determination has been decided or made on how to distribute those assets, then the successor trustees, co-successor trustees, their obligation is to distribute it according to Everett's directives. And in this case, his directive as to the limited partnership interest could not go to Janice, therefore it falls into the residual. Having gone into the residual, it goes to Jesse for as his, doesn't stay in the trust.
And when you're talking about the residual, you're talking about the residual in the will, is that correct?
There is a residual in the trust too, Your Honor. There's a paragraph in the trust itself, the very last paragraph, I believe it's a Section 3 of the trust, the disposition section after Everett dies, that says all other interest passes to my son Jesse.
So for one of a better way,
excuse me,
we'll assume Everett has a power of appointment over the assets within the trust. And we'll assume there are five assets within the trust. And he decided what he was going to do with the five assets, including the interest in the limited partnership. And he said the limited partnership interest would go to Janice, but that turns out to be impossible because Jesse wouldn't consent. And what you're arguing and what the Court of Chancery held is that to that extent, his power of appointment failed, and the failed power of appointment or designation of Janice resulted in the limited partnership interest going into the residue of the trust.
The one fact you stated, Your Honor, I think perhaps is incorrect, is that you said it would go there because Jesse did not consent. Under the facts of this case, Everett made that attempt to transfer without seeking any consent.
No, I understand that. But if we go back to the argument we're hearing from Mr. Gibbs, for your purposes, the result's the same. If he didn't get the inter vivos consent, or he didn't get the consent after death, he still didn't get the consent. Does that make any difference to your argument?
If the court were to find that the asset stayed in the trust, and that Jesse, as a limited partner, did not give consent, then the court would have to find that the trust would either continue for the balance of the term, or if the trust sought to a dissolution of some type, that would, I believe, trigger an event of withdrawal, which would require the 50% penalty. But you know, I think the court below, my position is the court below is correct, that the attempt to transfer without meeting the condition precedent of seeking consent voided that attempted gift, which dropped it into the residual that went to Jesse. And therefore, we don't even get to whether that asset is still a part of the limited partner, or part of the trust, for purposes of having to then seek consent and dissolution.
What's your position on whether the argument that we've heard today from the appellant is consistent with the argument that was fairly presented to the Court of Chancery?
That being the argument that, and I'm sorry, that being the argument that Jesse did not give consent?
No. Well, let me try to phrase it as I understand it, with the obvious caveat that I may have a misunderstanding, and the reason I ask the question is for you to resolve it. As I understand it, Janice, in discussing the Court of Chancery's decision, says that the decision allowed Jesse to withhold consent to the direct transfer of the interest to Janice, and that that is an appropriate application of Jesse's rights under the LPA, which I interpret in non-legalese to mean Jesse had a right to refuse consent to that transfer.
Correct.
Yet what was argued to the Court of Chancery, as I understand it, is his failure to consent was a breach of his fiduciary duties. That he, despite whatever right he may have had in the contract, because of his dual role as a co-trustee and a party to the limited partnership agreement, had breached his fiduciary duties. It represented self-dealing. He was in his capacity as a director of CONFAM, as a limited partner of EJKC, and as co-trustee, that those combined roles created an inherent fiduciary duty to carry out the wishes of his father, and his failure to do so was a breach of fiduciary duty. That's not the argument we've heard here.
No, and I don't think it was fairly presented. You know, the case below was on the basis that there was a bundle of rights, and that Jesse, as successor co-trustee, as limited partner, as general partner, had this fiduciary obligation to consent, and by failing to do so, breached his obligations to Janice. But as you indicate, Your Honor, it's now being presented, well, he did have the right as a limited partner, but there are still these other obligations that he, excuse me, that he would have to Janice. And the court below, I think, made the proper analysis of saying that the limited partner, as a limited partner, taking that aspect of Jesse's role in this, He had a contractual right to say, I don't want to consent, without breaching any fiduciary obligations to Janice. So the court below, I believe, had the right analysis, and here, you know, we're seeing that as, yes, he could withhold consent as a limited partner.
As I think I correctly understand the argument today, it's more than whether or not Jesse owed a fiduciary obligation to Janice. As a co-trustee, as I understand the argument, he took on the responsibility in that role, quite apart from his role as a limited partner and as a director of Confam. He had a role to, as a trustee of his father's trust, to carry out his father's wishes, and that his exercise of his failure to consent to the transfer is diametrically opposed to the role he plays as a co-trustee, which is to implement his father's wishes. How does that play out in our law? This is a very, in my mind, a very complicated dual role argument, one which is an assertion of clear, unambiguous contractual rights versus taking on the role as a co-trustee and the implied fiduciary duties under the common law that comes to a trustee of a trust. How do we sort that out in a way that is consistent with contractual rights and obligations and at the same time squared away with fiduciary duties?
First off, I don't think that Jesse would have that fiduciary duty because, as I explained, I think the property, these assets pass outside of the trust to him as a
So if the assets never get there, he's got no responsibility to implement the father's wish because they never got to the position where his role as a co-trustee would be triggered, at least as it applies to those assets.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Now, his obligation as to the other gifts, there were certain specific gifts to individuals. There were gifts to other gifts to Janice. I mean, those, there's no question he would have the obligation there. But as to the limited partnership interest, I don't think that he has that obligation, and that's what the court below found, that it went there.
Was the argument made below that if the attempt to transfer the partnership interest to Janice failed, that it did not go into the residue and the trust would continue 25 years, except for the fact that the co-trustees could try to dissolve the limited partnership?
That was discussed briefly at the oral argument.
Well, that's the centerpiece of this appeal now.
I understand. And I know that the rule says fairly presented, and I understand too in my reading that that's a fairly liberal standard, that if it was discussed below, so it was discussed. I don't know if it reaches the fairly presented standard.
Well, it certainly wasn't the basis for the Vice Chancellor's decision.
No, it was not, and it was not something that was a centerpiece of the discussion of the writings. It was briefly mentioned in oral argument.
Was it ever pleaded?
No, not that I recall. My recollection of the pleadings, it was not pled.
Well, why should we not remand it so it is considered by the Vice Chancellor?
Because I think that the Vice Chancellor had it correct in the first instance, and that there is no reason to remand this case because the bundle of rights coming from the limited partnership agreement that sets all the restrictions were breached, and to even consider it would give a certificate of approval to Everett's breach, and that he should not be permitted to have breached his obligation. The expectation that Jesse had in entering into this partnership in the first place and what they had agreed to. And there are letters there's a letter from Mr. Ellis in November of 2002 that is directed toward the limited partnership. And it's sent to both parties. It says, this is what has been transferred. This is the amount of time, or I'm sorry, the amount of money that has been deducted from the credits that you have under your estate tax. This is what's left. And lays out a whole scenario. Everett subsequently sent a letter to Mr. Ellis and said it's time to do another transfer. So when you look at the whole history of this limited partnership and you look at exactly what they were doing in the beginning and what Jesse's expectations are, to reband it, I think, would be furthering the breach that has already existed or have been made. And I would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the vice chancellor below, because I think he had it right. He understood exactly what the relationships were, analyzed those particular aspects of the agreements and the entire bundle of rights of the parties. So, you know, it's our position that the court below properly found Jesse was the owner of the limited partnership interest, properly decided that it would be inequitable for Everett to circumvent his duties of good faith and fair dealing to Jesse and try to shift to Jesse this duty to now have to deal with Janice in this consent aspect and the requirement of consent. So he wasn't, you know, Jesse wasn't the one who breached this. He isn't the one who sought to have this duty imposed on him. He is truly the injured and innocent one in this entire scenario. And you know, he's not the one that should have to suffer for that. So we would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision below.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Two quick items in rebuttal. Number one, the fairly presented issue. I'd like to clarify that below, my primary focus was on the Cantor decision, which I felt the Cantor decision made clear that there was an equitable limitation on a partner's right to withhold consent. I mean, when we discussed the case and when it was argued below, there wasn't an argument there that there was no consent right, because that was obviously, apparently, and in the face of everyone, that it was right there in the partnership agreement. At first instance, Jesse has that right. And that was stated below, and it's been stated on appeal. I think the primary difference between the way it was presented below and the way it's been presented above in this appeal is that I had such a difficult time filing this appeal that it came to me that the best way to do that would be to simply acknowledge that right and analyze this case on appeal from the standpoint of not muddying all the waters with his contract rights. But he has those contract rights, but yes, he's got these fiduciary rights, but they don't really come into play. It is very, very confusing. And so I think it's been presented differently to this court by way of clarification. I mean, there was an acknowledgement below that there was an equitable limitation.
Save your time.
Okay.
You do interpret that liberally, so move on to your standard.
So the second, I didn't understand what happened here as far as if the court would agree that this interest was void ab initio at the time he made his trust agreement, at the time Everett made his trust agreement. I don't agree with that. The court knows that. But there's only one way for Jesse to get this interest, and that is through the will and through the residuary clause. So either way, it doesn't go to Jesse.
You're saying it's through the residuary clause and the will, not the trust?
The residuary in the trust.
Okay.
Yes.
Um,
it can't go to Jesse under the trust because the interest is not subject of an indemption. It's not a lapse bequest. It's simply a bequest of a partnership that cannot be carried out without consent.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gibbs.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.